Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and you'd like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or you'd like to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. And then tonight, prosecutor and Women in Crime Inc. contributor, my favorite buddy, Donna Pendergrast, is with us this evening, as she has been for the entire month while Denny is on the road with Mob Month in Vegas.
Good evening, everybody. We'd like to bring up a couple shows before we get started with our first case. Susan will be on the Roth Show this Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and then she'll be on, I guess it's called the HearWomenTalk.com network. She'll be on 2 hours on the Susan Murphy Milano Show. Time's up. That'll be 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, my show, Crime Time with Vito Colucci, that's on Sunday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern Time. And the first case we're going to highlight is a case that I talked about a few weeks ago on my show. It is about Caitlin Arquette, age 18, who was murdered in Albuquerque on July 16, 1989. The Albuquerque police dubbed the shooting a random drive-by and refused to investigate any other possibility. The case has never been solved. Kate's family believes she was killed because she was a potential whistleblower. In the months directly preceding her murder, Kate was in a position to have gained information about a number of illegal activities involving dangerous and corrupt individuals. Among those activities were of the following: Asian crime in New Mexico and California, drug smuggling, drug activities involving New Mexico VIPs, and police corruption. Tonight, the CrimeWire team is going to present a full hour on this case. Joining us are Caitlin's mother and author, Lois Duncan Arquette, CrimeWire consultant and Arquette family investigator, Pat Caristo, and CrimeWire consultant and statement analyst, Peter Hyatt. Lois, and I believe your husband's name is Don, am I correct?
Yes, and Don's okay, on the extension.
Okay, we welcome both of you to our show tonight. And why don't you start off by telling our listeners across the country a little bit about your daughter so they have a little feel of, she was 18 years old when this horrible act happened. Why don't you explain to them a little bit about what type of a girl she was?
Kate was 18 years old, as he just said, and she was an honor student, and she was a straight arrow, and she fell in love with the wrong man. She fell in love with a young Vietnamese man who's very attractive, and she graduated from high school and got her own apartment. She was working at Pier 1 Imports so she could support herself. And she allowed him to move in with her. And a couple of months later, she was driving home from a girlfriend's house and was shot twice in the head. and survived for 20 hours in a coma and was taken off life support. And after that, we found out about all kinds of illegal activities that this boyfriend and his group of associates were involved in. And I'm a writer, and so I wrote a book about it called Who Killed My Daughter. And
you're not just a writer, though. You are a famous crime author. So, you know, it is a shame and tragic that you had to do this kind of a book for your daughter.
It was unbelievable. It was like every nightmare I ever wrote about in my suspense novels, my Lois Duncan suspense novels that teenagers were gobbling up all over the country. It's like every nightmare I ever had suddenly turned real, and it was our child.
Right. I know. You've gone from writing all these books, tons of books,
50.
Many of them made into TV shows, others that were made into major motion pictures, one of them being Hotel for Dogs, that a lot of people watched. It was a very popular movie at the time. And now you have to sit, you have to put the details out of what you know in your daughter's case. You know, what I'd like to do is I'd like to get private investigator Pat Caristo, top private investigator, in on this right away. And Pat, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about the mother laid the groundwork here, but what have you found? You've been working on this case quite a while, and you've been helping this family tremendously. Give us some other details of why this whole thing looks fishy, or why no action was taken.
What was interesting is how I got involved in the case was just to investigate the circumstances of a drive-by shooting for a possible insurance claim, and that I had no contact with the family, just for the attorney that was looking at the matter, and I had to get copies of the police reports, and I couldn't get them. The police wouldn't release them. So what the attorney had me do was reconstruct the traffic accident, quote-unquote traffic accident, or drive-by shooting, and then submit that information to an accident reconstructionist to come up with whether or not the shots were fired from a moving vehicle. That was the critical piece of information that that attorney needed. While I was doing that and got access to the records and the case file, I began to realize that there had been a man found at the scene standing next to the victim's car, and yet he was never interviewed by police in any of the material that I saw. And in any case, you would know that he was at least a witness,
right,
should have been interviewed. But as I identified him and checked public records and court records, I found out that this person had had at least 9 unprovoked attacks against women, violent, and I thought, well, he should be a suspect. I was sure that the Albuquerque Police Department was looking at that. I just didn't have access to the information. So we let that off to the side, and the aspect of what I was working on fell off. And then 2 years later, I saw Mrs. Arquette on the Sally Jesse Raphael show, where they were with some other mothers, crime victims, and talking about why they needed more information in the case. And Mrs. Arquette was very vocal about what all they knew, but she didn't know anything or wasn't saying anything about the man found at the scene of the crime. So at the end of the show, I called in with that piece of information, and no one had known that. It's contained in the first couple of police reports, but all the information that went out later on came from the homicide report. All of that information was not included in the homicide report. So to this day, many years later, those key pieces of information about what happened at the crime scene, who was there first, who wasn't there, which officer arrived first, who took whose name, none of that information has been answered. So therefore, to come up with an investigative hypothesis is impossible because we don't have one known fact.
Yeah, and also our listeners, Pat, need to understand that the family now has moved away. Lois and her husband, Don, have moved away to a different state.
Yes,
after my book came out, we got death threats to the rest of us, and we left Albuquerque.
And you were also told, don't bother us again. The case is a random shooting. It's done. Leave us alone. Am I correct with that, Lois?
Yes, you're correct with that.
All right, now let me ask you one more question, Pat, before we move on with everybody else. You're based out of where? Are you based out of Albuquerque? I know.
Yes.
Okay. And just because I've had this situation before on local cases, how has that affected you as a private investigator that's based out of Albuquerque, working very hard on this case where the family has been told basically to get lost and have moved out of state? Has anybody said things to you like, why don't you put it to rest and get off this case, or no?
Yes.
Okay.
I've been told, why am I trying to take down an impeccable department? I have been asked, why are you still alive?
Really?
Yes.
That's interesting. Yeah, okay.
And over the course of the investigation of Caitlin's case, we have linked people connected to Kate's case to at least 10 other killings in New Mexico. So part of the problem becomes Kate's case is not isolated. It is interactive with other cases.
Wow. Now, Prosecutor Donna Pendergast, what do you think about a police department that has told a top private detective who's trying to help a family, trying to get to the answers no matter what they may be, to why are you still alive?
Well, Vito, you know, I guess everything has to be taken in context. You know me, prosecutor, I'm a staunch defender of the police. And, you know,
I guess my question is if that is true. I mean, if that is in fact true, what they have said to her, get off the case, why are you doing this? Why are you making us look bad? I know how that works from being the next cop. And even somebody getting to the point of saying, hey, why are you still alive? You know, I mean, if we're talking about this and basing all those things as factual, let's say, okay, let's just take that approach. Well, I mean, what does that shout out to you about on this?
Well,
I understand
your
point. You're looking at everything very, you know, upfront. You know, what if this, what if that, and the whole bit. But I'm just trying to see what that, you know, says to you as a prosecutor.
Well, you know, obviously, I mean, assuming, and that's a big assumption, but all of that is accurate, then, you know, you've got some real questions to be asked. It's like, what are people trying to hide here? What is the department trying to hide? Frankly, I have to tell you, in 24 years, I've never encountered a case where I thought the police were hiding something. That doesn't mean I don't think it ever happens. I'm by no means saying. I mean, if somebody tells you, why are you still alive, those are some pretty damning words.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, every so often, different jurisdiction, things like that happen. When I did an investigation on my own bosses, I was told to let it go. I said, no, I wasn't going to let it go, and my bosses were indicted for murder. But that's a different situation. So I know how that goes sometimes when somebody whispers in your ear, why don't you let it go, right? Is that right, Pat Caristo?
Yes, and just to be absolutely accurate, it was not the police department who asked me why I wasn't still alive, or why I was still alive, excuse me. It was people connected to the police department, that was the word on the street, why is Pat Caristo still alive? And I want to say that my background is 18 years of law enforcement. I still consider myself to be a proponent of law enforcement, and throughout my whole investigation of the Arquette case, my purpose has always been that the Albuquerque Police Department is the one who solves this case. I have turned over everything I have to them with the idea that they would solve it. They're the ones who should solve it.
Well,
so I'm not anti-law enforcement.
None of us are, but what, Pat, do you think is really hindering this? What there's something there that you believe is not moving forward because what do you think is there?
There's it can be as simple as they screwed up at the scene, and then they had to justify why they didn't process this man at the scene. So they kept pushing it away. Then it got to be out of their control, and now there's a cover up of an innocent act. Now there is other information to possibly indicate that there may have been some officers that were involved in criminal activity, and people connected to Kate were involved in that. And Kate's actions and talking about what the Vietnamese were doing and what she knew would have opened that up. So I don't have the answer, but it's as simple as an initial cover-up of, oh, we screwed up, we don't want a civil lawsuit, and then it got out of hand, or something more sinister than that.
Donna Pendergast, in a case like this, is it possible for someone like the investigator, like Pat or the family, to bypass the department's, if you will, red tape or you know, blue veil here, and go to somebody in the Attorney General's office in that state or in the District Attorney's office? Is that something that could be helpful to them?
Well, you know, Susan, that's an interesting question. Every state is different. In Michigan, I'm not going to say that never happens, because there have been cases. The Attorney General is the top law enforcement official in the state. That being said, you know, there simply is not enough resources to look at every case. So we are very reluctant to second-guess the decision of a local prosecutor.
But if the prosecutor's not in there, though, if we're saying that it's not even probably getting to that point, is what I'm kind of hearing, that it's not going past law enforcement, so couldn't they just go ahead above them?
Yeah, in every county, at least in Michigan here, every county has a prosecutor for a reason, and most of those prosecutors' offices do have investigators. So if you catch the ear of the local prosecutor and they believe that, you know, there is, in fact, something that needs to be looked at, you know, there's always the exception to the general rule. And, yeah, you know, I was a county prosecutor for 18 years. Yeah, there were cases that's like, this needs to be looked at. We're going to, you know, send our own investigators in on it. But, you know, it has to be an extraordinary situation.
I think just warranted,
Susan,
don't you?
How about Peter Hyatt? Do you think Peter has any, as a statement analyst, what has he read into this whole thing?
That's a good point.
What I gave Peter was transcripts of a phone interview, a taped phone interview I had with the last person to see Kate alive.
And who was that?
Her name was Sharon. And Kate left our home the night she was killed, saying she was going to Sharon's house for dinner, that she had broken up with the Vietnamese boyfriend. If he called, trying to find her, not to tell him where she was. And she went to Sharon's. There has been a lot of controversy here about Sharon saying one thing to the police, another thing to us. So I had one conversation with Sharon by phone that was taped. And another investigator, who was an insurance fraud investigator out of California, named Michael Bush, had an interview of his own, which was taped with Sharon. And she said one thing to me and one thing to Michael. And so what I gave Peter was transcripts of both, and thinking that, which is the truth?
And Peter Hyatt, what have you surmised in reviewing these documents?
Well, it's an interesting conversation that she had with Sharon Smith. Sharon Smith is clearly withholding information, and I have some real concerns that Sharon Smith's fear was not so much of retributive violence, but that I think that she has a connection with the ex-boyfriend. Is his name Dunn? Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, it's spelled D-U-N-G. It's pronounced Yun in the Vietnamese version, but most people call it Dung.
Okay. I'm concerned about how several times she used what we call self-references, where she said, you know, like I said, which means that she's speaking from not from experiential memory, but she's speaking from remembering what she said before. And then Lois is another part of the conversation where she attempts to persuade you of what you said, and that was something that did not take place. What this tells me is that she is withholding, or at least at this time, she was withholding information that was vital to this. I have a suspicion. I'm not sure if I should go that far with the suspicion, but I will go as far as to say she is withholding critical information regarding the people that your daughter was associated with.
Explain what statement analysis is, please, for the listeners of those that are listening that do not understand the importance of this.
Statement analysis is a scientific study of the words that people speak that is able to tell us with about the same accuracy as a polygraph machine whether someone's being truthful or not. A good example would be Susan Smith. She reported her sons had been carjacked, but when she spoke about them in the past tense, we knew that the boys were dead. So we listen very carefully to the words that are chosen, and we're able to tell truth from fiction when someone speaks.
Can I make a compliment to Mr. To Peter? I didn't get your last name again. Say it, Peter
Hyatt.
Hyatt. You in a handful of words encapsulated exactly what investigation has revealed about Sharon Smith. That was wonderful. I'm truly impressed.
Well, that's why he's here. He's good at what he does. People don't understand that. Yeah, Vito.
I was just going to ask Pat Caristo, because she's right on top of this case here. This case goes back many years, okay? It's 22 years old
1989.
Okay, yeah. So we're talking about a 22-year-old case. I would imagine that most of the police officers that were involved at that time in any capacity would, good possibility that are most of them retired, or any, and not only retired, then they're scattered all over the country type of a thing. Am I correct?
Now, that's so interesting that you say that, because everybody says that, and it turned out that we went to do something in another case, and a person directly related to a suspicious location that Caitlin was involved in, that police officer is in charge of a specific unit now.
Oh, really?
Even every time we think we have gotten to the point where there's a whole new group of people that we can talk to that is unbiased, that person was in charge that would be able to control information. And most police officers believe their associates, because they're there to back them up and have their back. And that's what happened at the crime scene. The initial words of the criminalistics report was the supervisor of the criminalistics. When I got there, I was met by X and Y. Y helped us with the scene. Y shouldn't have had any input into the scene, but because of his position and prior role, was someone you would believe. And so when you got there and Y would say to you, I found this trail, this, that's what they acted on. In good faith, but mistakenly. And Y, that person, may have very well been able to direct this case away from where it needed to go in the first 5-10 minutes, which colors everything for even 22 years.
Well,
Donna Pendergast.
Go ahead.
Donna, I have a silly idea. If they were to take cases out in Albuquerque, New Mexico, actually I can think of one, Tara Chavez, and it was a cover-up. She happened to be married to a police officer. Now the family is suing Albuquerque Police Department because of some things that had happened at the crime scene. Is there a way for Pat or the family to take a few cases, that one, a few others, and I could probably research some of them, where the Albuquerque, Mexico, there's a pattern of conduct in these cases, and perhaps then take it for to the U.S. Attorney's Office out there for corruption, perhaps, because you can show the pattern of what hasn't happened. Is that a possibility, Donna?
It is a possibility, Susan, although I have to tell you that proving some sort of pattern of corruption would be an extremely difficult thing. I mean, talk about climbing up a mountain. That's what we're talking about here.
It's a mountain I like. It's a mountain, and I'm thinking that the people that are responsible, as we all say, or I try to say on every show, somebody's listening because they have an interest in this. And somebody's listening because they know something. So I do think it's possible. It is a long shot, but I don't think it's that much of a long shot based on the fact that because of the Internet, because of families, I think they can put together that pattern of conduct. It's a shot. It's more than what's not there is all I'm suggesting.
It's a good point, Susan. Like Donna says, it's a tough thing to do, and the only reason I'm chiming in on that is because it took me 7 years, and I had to finally get to the point where the FBI believed in me, okay, where they backed me up, and not only 7 years, I had to wear a wire for two of it, okay? So it's a very tough climb up that hill. Okay, it's a very, very tough climb, but you know, I understand you know what you're all saying, because it's a shame if all these facts are correct that we've been discussing here tonight, because it's absolutely horrible. Not only that a family feels they have to even leave their town to move away. That's terrible.
Right. Well, let me insert one piece of information that I don't think any of you have been aware of, because it was not in the information we gave you. But the crime stuff that this Vietnamese group was involved in, what I found out about in the early days of this investigation, of the police investigation before Pat ever entered the scene, Don and I found out about this group being involved in car wreck insurance fraud scam, where they'd import people to California to stage wrecks and collect the insurance and come back home and so forth.
But that's
so
what's going on with the case I just said. I'm not trying to be interrupted.
We caught that, but and that's been documented. So
okay.
That was the tip of the iceberg, though, and that's all I knew when Pat heard me talking on that TV show. And then once Pat came into the game, and once my book came out, and once people began to contact us with new information, we got our eyes opened to an entirely different thing than we thought we were on to. We were on to, as I say, the tip of the iceberg. But for instance, one of Kate's co-workers at Pier 1 Imports contacted us to say that heroin from Asia was being imported through that store where Kate worked as manager of imported clothing. And it would come via UPS. Probably the manager of the store didn't know about it. But it was coming from Asia, that this young woman told us she had actually opened a box and found some in there and had taken it to the FBI, and they had confiscated it, and she didn't know what had happened next, but 2 weeks later, Kate shot dead. So did Kate find out about that? The Vietnamese boyfriend and his friends were at Pier 1 all the time because Kate was there. They had an excuse to be visiting Kate. They were on the loading docks, off of the loading docks, all over the store. Now, there is something that is much more serious than car wreck insurance scam. This is smuggling of drugs into the country. And so the more information we get, the more this thing builds, and the scarier it becomes.
Lois Duncan, Donna Pendergast here. Let me ask you this, or let me say this. Just so our listeners understand, can you give us a timeline of the last hours as you know it, or as you've been told, of Kate's life, what she did and where she was, and why it just doesn't seem to add up?
Well, when we got up that morning, Don and I went down to the breakfast table. Kate, who had her own apartment, had come over and was sitting at our kitchen table and crying. And she said that something very bad had come between her and Yoon, and she's breaking up with him, and she never wanted to see him again. And she hung around. She wouldn't tell us what it was. She hung around our place half of the day. She tried to talk me into going to a movie with her that afternoon, and I'd already seen the movies, and I had work to do, so I didn't go. And boy, have I cursed myself ever since then.
Yeah, but that's common. You know that's common, and it's
I didn't,
people that are listening.
I didn't know how important it was that those would be the last hours I get to spend with her. But then she left, and then she called from the apartment. She'd gone back to the apartment, and she said Yoon was not there, and she was going to go to her friend Sharon's house for dinner, and would I pick up some wine coolers for her to take to Sharon's house? And I said I would, and Kate couldn't buy liquor yet. And then I said, no, I called her back. I said, I can't, it's Sunday. The liquor store's not open. She said, okay, I'll take ice cream. And then she came over to our house at 6 o'clock, and I know exactly what time she arrived because 60 Minutes had just started. And she hung around with us until about 20 past 6, said, now I'm going to Sharon's for 6:30 dinner, and she left. And as far as we knew, she went to Sharon's for 6:30 dinner. Sharon told the police that Kate arrived at her house at 9:30. That's in the police reports. When I said that in my book, Sharon went to all extremes to contact me, to tell me, no, 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 that's not true. She didn't get here at 9:30. She got here at 7. She came from a 5 o'clock movie. And I said, well, that's impossible because she was at our house till 6:20. She couldn't have come from a 5 o'clock movie. Well, that threw Sharon off, killed her. I think this is maybe what Peter was referring to, in the fact that this, you know, it just doesn't work. Sharon was trying to convince us of one thing. She told the police something else. We don't know when Kate got to Sharon's house. But if Kate did leave our house at 20 past 6 and got to Sharon's at 9:30, as Sharon originally told the police, that would mean there are 3 missing hours in Kate's final evening that nobody knows where she was or what was happening. So,
well,
Peter Hyatt,
is there any connection that you know of between this Sharon and your daughter's boyfriend at the time, Mr.
Yes.
Yoon Won, I think?
Yes.
What is that connection?
Go ahead, Lois. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, you carry it, Pat.
The idea that Caitlin was coming to Sharon Smith's home that night was to help Sharon decorate the apartment. It was a townhome, and there were 2 units, the townhome of the man who lived in the second unit. It turned out that that man worked at the place. It was an artist who worked out of the place where Dung worked. When the police took the information from Sharon, Sharon provided Dung's name, the telephone number where he worked, and the name of Dung's supervisor. And yet she says she didn't know Dung. And yet when we have interviews with other friends, she did know him. So Sharon's information is always inconsistent with the facts. The funeral, Sharon was supposed to attend the funeral, but she didn't, because she said she was bitten by a dog, and yet the hospital records indicate that she was not bitten by a dog, and it indicated that she may have very well been cut.
By someone.
And interesting, in the 3 weeks around Caitlin's death, 3 or 4 of the people directly connected to Kate were involved in
cuttings. None of this seemed of interest to the police department.
Go another ahead, interesting thing was as soon as immediately after Kate's death, Sharon applied for Kate's job at Pier 1
yes.
Imports. And Sharon was responsible for seeing the imported things from the shipments from the Orient. She brought her boyfriend in to work on the loading docks. And a couple of weeks later, they both stopped coming in.
Within
and
a week.
Didn't even pick up their paychecks.
Peter Hyatt, speak to this, because there was people that are listening. In 1989, there were no cell phones. We didn't have GPSs, no technology. So how important is statement analysis and behavior and pattern of conduct in this entire case when you are minus technology?
Well, words still solve cases. And statement analysis will tell me if someone's truthful or not, and I was able to see that Sharon wasn't truthful. There's also a lack of bond between Sharon and Kate. But here's just a guess, is I think that Sharon was bullied into setting Kate up for the execution. That once Kate broke off with her boyfriend, she was going to have secrets that could be taken outside their fold, and that code can't be broken. So in order for the business to keep going as it is, they had her arrange something. And she may not have known that she was going to be killed or not. I think that she did. But I think that she may have been bullied and frightened into doing this herself and actually setting Kate up to be where she was.
Can I just say
shooting.
Again to Mr. Hyatt, you are exactly right. That is exactly what the investigation shows. And there is some indication that Sharon was placed by people in some kind of authority to be outside of Pier 1 to operate this snow cone cart that she was doing for the purpose of making this contact with Kate. And that the evening was set up, and your comment about the lack of bonding is very interesting. You're a fascinating man, and I'm thoroughly impressed.
Lois Duncan, let me ask you this. Because our listeners don't understand as much of the facts as all of us on the show do tonight because we've read the background, but you referred to this snow cone cart. What was the relationship between your daughter and Sharon? How had they met? And explain to us what you mean by a snow cone cart.
Well, Sharon and a man that that said he was Sharon's husband, rented the space in front of Pier 1 Imports in order for Sharon to set up a snow cone cart and sell it right there. And they said this was extremely important to have it there. They said they were setting it up with money that Sharon had just inherited from her parents who had died in Texas. Well, we found out later, Sharon's parents are alive and well. She didn't get money from somebody in Texas. The description of the man who was with her does not match the physical description of her then husband. And so she went to quite an extreme to set up this cart right in front of where Kate worked. Whether that was done and then she met Kate by accident or whether it was done because she wanted to meet Kate, we have no idea. But Kate met her during her breaks. Kate would come out and buy a snow cone and start to chat with Sharon, and they became friends that way. Sharon was a comparatively new friend. They'd known each other maybe 6 weeks. This was the first time that Kate had been invited to Sharon's home.
And Sharon was 30. Caitlin was 18.
Vito.
Yes.
You know, the crime scene investigators speculate that the scene might have been altered before the investigators got there. How difficult is that to do in a case like this?
Well, for what we read here, the criminalistics
they were met at the scene by this Sergeant Galagos, if I'm pronouncing his name right. And it says most of their report was based upon the information that this Galagos gave to them rather than their own personal observations, which are very important. Now, and don't forget the little background on this Galagos. He was supposedly what's called a rogue cop who they got him partying at this chop shop. Okay, that was one half block north of the crime scene. And not only that, we're saying all that, but then we can go to some other proof, which he has been since fired for burglarizing a liquor store while on duty. So it's not just, you know, stuff we're throwing out up in the wind here. You know, that kind of jumps out at us. How do you feel about that, Lois? His involvement.
Just like you do.
Okay.
I mean, we've got somebody who is obviously an untrustworthy cop at the scene before anyone else gets there, feeding information to good cops who arrived later, but arrived quite a bit later because they were working on another case before they got to Kate's scene. And so this guy could tell them anything he wanted to tell them. And they're writing information down, and because he's one of them, and they're trusting their own, which I can certainly understand. Cops have to trust each other's word, but something was very wrong about this whole presentation of the crime scene.
Pat Caristo, talk to the audience about the shooting occurred after the truck hit the utility pole, after her car hit it, and it suggests that basically the way I saw it was that somebody just kind of went up to her and fired. Why wasn't there forensic or ballistics to show, you know, the trajectory of the bullet, what had really happened?
I don't know. The Albuquerque Police Department writes the report that the shooting occurred 716 feet west of where the car ended up. And they establish that by what they refer to as the greatest concentration of glass in the street. And yet, when you look at the crime scene photos, there's a picture of that location, but there's no glass in the street. No glass is ever collected, excuse me, and no glass is documented.
And it's very strange where the blood is.
And the bullet in the car, in the window, that struck into Kate's head is different than a bullet hole in the support beam between the two doors. That's also a slightly different, appears to be a different caliber. Part of the problem is nothing was recovered. There was not sufficient grains, even though it was a closed head injury. Not sufficient grains were recovered to determine caliber, so they're estimating that it was a .22. The two wounds to her head were a .22 because of the lack of fragments. But the larger caliber was not recovered. There were nothing recovered at the scene. And the bullet hole that's in the car was
the frame,
not found by the two police officers. It was found and discovered and identified by the rescue worker, even though there were two police officers, one a detective and one a uniformed officer who had a prior experience as a field service officer. They didn't recognize it as a crime scene. It was considered an accident without injuries for a period of time. So for about 20-25 minutes, that scene was unprotected. And they allowed this man, found standing next to the car, saying, "Oh, I found her that way," allowed him to leave the scene without proper identification. And later on, when investigators would look at this information, they never interviewed him. Never.
What about the interview notes? How extensive are they with people? And actually, Peter Hyatt, is our interview notes just as important as statement notes? And on a police report, can you tell when someone is not being truthful in the interview notes that they write during the investigation?
Yes, if the officer has training that is to write down exact quotes whenever he can, they're just as useful. So it can be a great tool.
Because we've not heard much about police reports and different things in these kind of cases where they didn't do their jobs or you know, just bypassed important information Did you have an opportunity to look at that through this case file at all?
Well, one thing that, that must be remembered is that there's a human element that's behind the scenes sometimes that we don't always understand. There may be an honest police officer who makes $30,000 a year. This is back in 1989. He has two children, and he gets who go to school locally in the schools there. He gets approached and is told that something's going to happen this evening, and you mind your own business, and your kids will be fine. He's scared to death. It's not necessarily that he's dishonest, but this can happen. And and these type of taintings can creep in, and these people may fear for their own lives, the lives of their children. The problem I see now is that there may be members of that gang that are likely no longer alive because the lifespan is not terribly long, and there may be police officers that had information that have retired now. So it is really difficult.
Let me ask Pat something, coming off of what Peter just said. Pat, you know, we mentioned before about what people have said to you about working the case, but on the other end, have you gotten people that have come up to you, whispered good things in your ear about the case, tried to give you some good information now many years later? A former gang member maybe that has seen the light and has moved on and knows some information. Have you had things like that?
We have had lots of information on this case from a variety of people. Some of them have been police officers who said, I know you're just trying to do your job. Let me give you what I can. So we've had a variety of information from different
sources.
But
they all say, don't ever use my name. Excuse me, Pat. The police officers who tell us things don't want to be identified.
And part of the problem is there is not that one piece of information that will nail this down. The police reports are written in ways to obfuscate. For example, one of the big pieces of information is a Volkswagen bug, and yet there's Volkswagen bugs that were never identified. When one Volkswagen bug is identified as being spray-painted in Caitlin's apartment complex parking lot by the Vietnamese from her apartment, spray painting this car black, and the police are looking for a gray or black Volkswagen bug. When the statement is given to the police, they say the Vietnamese were spray painting a Volkswagen bug. When the police report is written, it said the neighbor said they were spray painting a small car. No one never, ever refers to a Volkswagen bug as a small car.
I also think, you know, in some of the excerpts of the book, you know, you go to a writer's conference and you get a note in an envelope, and the note says, Mrs. Arquette, I wish you the best in finding Kate's killer. I don't think I have the answers you seek, but someday I would like to meet you. You're a strong mother, and I wish Kate had introduced us before she left. I hope this arrangement shows that there are some out here who are still looking and love her very much. Rod, Peter Hyatt, what does that tell you?
The first thing I heard was that I don't think there's a weakness in that statement. It means that there's possibly your other thoughts. So I'd like to follow up with that one. You never know.
How? Because you get this envelope. You know, you're at a conference, Lois, and you get this envelope, and you say that you had felt like somebody had crashed into your chest. With the fifth.
With a bouquet of flowers.
With a bouquet of flowers, a note
delivered
came
to my table while I'm sitting at the luncheon, writer's conference luncheon. Yes, and then he did contact us.
And you did speak to him?
Yes, and we have talked to him over the years, and apparently this young man, whose name I'm not going to use, was seeing Kate on the side. She was getting ready to break up with Yoon. She's dovetailing her romances. She had not been intimate in any way with this young man. But
did you know about this person?
Not at the time.
Okay.
But since then, I have found out that what he says is true, that she had this side boyfriend that she would meet when Yoon would go out with his friends for the night, and leave her alone. She'd meet
him. Was there something?
I
do a lot of intimate partner homicide crimes and things. What is there something in what you were told by this person that she was acquaintances with, that she would hang out with, that he knew anything about this guy? Not so much why he was breaking up, but perhaps maybe what in my mind, what she was frightened of this guy about. Yoon.
No, he did not. He said she was very close-mouthed about Yoon. He did not know about the car wreck scam. But one thing that she said to him is really, really kind of horrifying to me. She shortly before she was shot, she said to him, "What would you do if I died?"
And
that's not the kind of thing a young woman casually drops.
It is if they are in a situation and in a relationship that is what I deem as the smell change. They may not be always able to identify it, but sometimes we say things ahead of the event and not really, we say it out loud so that somebody hears it almost outside of ourselves, or we're conscious of it. But it's very common in the cases where the relationship, there's something wrong. There's a sense of discovering something wrong or wrong behavior. So in that situation, in my opinion, that was common for her to say that. It's not what person says it. It's that a person says it when they're in a situation that they smell and see a danger, but sometimes they can't put their finger on it.
That makes sense.
Caitlin was also telling her therapist about her concerns about dirty money and about a death in an accident. And some of these people involved in these staged car accidents actually died, not deliberately the outcome that was expected, but they died. And Caitlin was concerned about that. That counselor, psychiatrist, tried to call the police department to give her information in response to the police call for help. And the police declined. They said that they had all the information they needed. They did not need her information.
Lois, when your book came out, Who Killed My Daughter, over time, you know, and this happens too, after the fact, did people come out or did you get descriptive or cryptive messages or information perhaps that would help you get closer to really understanding who knew what and what was going on?
Yes. Yes, we began to get information, but you've got to realize that we're talking about a murder that took place a long time ago. We didn't even have computers at that point.
But
your
mind is your, if I can say that, your mind is your computer, like I tried to say earlier. For those listening, when there's this kind of a death and we're caught off guard, you remember every single detail of every single moment.
I remember
it
because I wrote it down.
That's right.
I'm a writer, and I took notes because I knew I was in shock, and I knew I might misremember. And so I wrote down, I kept a journal of every single thing that was said, and I taped every phone call. In New Mexico, it was legal to do that. And so that when I quoted anything, I would be absolutely certain that it was accurate. And so my account is totally accurate because it's all documented. In fact, when the publisher looked at the manuscript, they had me come meet with their legal department and bring a whole suitcase of documentation, and I could back up every single thing I said in that book. And we've never had a single thread of a libel suit.
I would like to do something that I always hear Peter Hyatt ask when we do these shows, about you, and I'd like to hear from Don, if I could, about, you know, your faith in God and how you've stayed together and the importance of seeking justice as a family and you know, keeping together.
I'll pass that to Don.
Well, it's been difficult. Lois was totally immersed in the writing of the book and all the events that followed. And I was, of course, trying to continue my career and working very hard in that area. I tried to be as supportive as I could.
But you're still together. You know, you're still together.
Yes, very much. I didn't try to get personally involved in helping her, quote unquote.
But you stayed together, and I think that it's important for people to understand how important it is to stay together, how important faith is. And
I think it's a miracle we stayed together, actually, because when we really, I mean, we clung together through the bad time, and it's still a bad time because there's no closure.
Mm-hmm.
But the turning point, I think, for Don's entrance into this case was when we did have a computer and we set up an internet website, which is Kate Arquette, Arquette.com, Kate spelled K-A-I-T, and a message board and everything so people can read the whole story and people can give us information and contact us by email. And Don was the technical person. He could handle all that, and I couldn't. And so suddenly he became the instrumental person in this investigation, and that balanced our marriage a lot. And he has been working with Pat.
Pat, where do we go next on the case? Where, what do you see happening hopefully next?
There are some steps that Lois and Don are looking to take, and I'm not sure that I should make.
No,
that,
you shouldn't. Just to know that you are.
That they are. But one of the interesting things is that Lois did such a good job at writing Who Killed My Daughter and making her case against the Vietnamese as suspects in the case that the district attorney said that they didn't want to go further, because if they ever found another suspect, the defense for the suspect would use Lois's book against them, so therefore they didn't want to take the case further.
Donna, weigh in on that, please.
Well, you know, what I want to say above all is, because I've been a prosecutor and my specialty is cold cases, and I'm going to veer off your question a little bit here and just say that, you know, when a lot of people think there's no hope left in a case, we've exhausted all leads, I'm the person who can tell you there always is hope, because I have prosecuted 3 cases that were 30 years old, a couple of them that were 18 to 20 years old. You know, there is always hope that the critical piece of the puzzle will fall into place. I'm living proof of that. And, you know, so I've seen a lot of cases like this, and you can say, well, it's been 22 years, and, you know, but, you know, there's always hope, and you still have leads out there, and, you know, you just never know. One day, bam, it's happened to me over and over again. I've seen it. Living proof
and
that,
yes,
you know what?
It's been 22 years, but it seems like yesterday. And when I sleep at night, I hear gunshots, and I hear a voice calling, Mother, and I'm not there. And, I mean, after 22 years, that's still my nightly dream. And parents don't get over this.
No one does.
Brothers and sisters have not gotten over this, certainly.
You couldn't.
And because we keep getting new information, that's what's kept us going, because it's not stagnant. New people keep contacting us and contacting Pat.
We are out of time. The website is Kate Arquette. Arquette.com. You can go to the CrimeWire site and get more information, and also follow the forum for discussion. We'd like to thank Donna Pendergast, who's been with us this entire month while Denny's been on the road with Mob Tour. We really appreciate it. Denny returns next week, and Vito's off, and Ann Bremner's coming in for the night. Watch out, Vito.
That's right.
Joining us. Thank you to our CrimeWire team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, Public Relations team at Imagine Publicity, Our next show will be Tuesday, February 1st, 2001. Tune in as we dissect, analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. or hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play.
And remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. Make sure you listen in next week. My good friend Ann Bremner, who is on television, she's an authority, voted one of the top attorneys in the entire country, will be the guest host while I'm traveling. So tonight, God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Pendergrass, Denny Griffith, oh boy, I put them together now all of a sudden, Donna Pendergast and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.
Night, everybody.
Good night.